Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Walter Russell Mead, who is the Henry A. Kissinger Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and one of the country's leading students of U.S. foreign policy. His book, Special Providence, American Foreign Policy and How It Changed the World, is a classic in the field. His new book is God and Gold, Britain and America, and the Making of the Modern World. Walter, welcome back to Berkeley.
It's great to be here again.
How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, one answer would be all my life, in that a lot of my experiences and thinking and reading over the decades really helped contribute to it. But I've been working on this pretty hard for most of the last 5 years.
And what were you trying to do here? What is your main thesis?
Well, it seems to me, if you look at world history, that there are two things that are fairly obvious. For the last 300 years, either Britain or the United States, or both, have been on the winning sides in every major great power conflict. That means not smaller wars like Vietnam or Korea, but the big wars like the World Wars or the Cold War that's kind of set the international system from generation to generation. And so they've been strong. But it's also impressive how wrong they've been so often about what victory meant. Mm-hmm. What we heard at the end of the Cold War about the end of history was so much just the same thing that was heard after World War II, after World War I with the League of Nations. So strong but wrong. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to look at that. How could you be so strong and be so wrong? What are the implications? But also, if we have been wrong about where history was headed or what these victories meant, what is happening? What is this all about? So those are the questions I've tried to answer.
And was this a logical outcome of your previous studies on U.S. foreign policy?
Well, in some ways, it's very much related to Special Providence, which was, it started in a way with me trying to write a fairly conventional history of American foreign policy. But as I got into it, I was just struck by how much that I thought I knew turned out not to be true. That America had been isolationist. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. And then in this book, again, we're given this kind of picture of the history of the modern world as the rise and fall of Europe or the rise and fall of the West. Mm-hmm. But as I began to actually look into modern world history, what you see is after the British defeated the French in the Seven Years' War, ending in 1763, actually, the Europeans weren't that militarily dominant beyond the confines of Europe. Mm-hmm. And where they did establish these 19th century somewhat ephemeral empires in places like Africa, they always depended on a kind of a tacit British consent. Mm-hmm. And that really, if you look at the history of the modern world, I think what you see is this rise of a global system of trade, of finance, of culture, of power, of ideology that was British for a long time is now American. But that system, I call it the maritime system or the maritime order in the book, was stronger in 2000 than it was in 1900, stronger in 1900 than in 1800, stronger in 1800 than in 1700. And so I set out to try to understand what was happening.
I got the impression that in a way you were trying to answer the question, why do they hate us, after the 9/11 events? But to answer that question, you had to go back and answer the question, well, who are we? What is this Anglo-American culture? Do we understand ourselves? And I thought you were saying, well, maybe we don't, and we have to go over what the story is.
Well, the germ of the book came actually before 9/11. I was reading along in some old speeches of Oliver Cromwell, as we so often do. Mm-hmm. And there was this speech where in a war with Spain in 1656, he says to Parliament, "Who are our enemies and why do they hate us?" And the answer, it's the league of all the evil men on earth. Mm-hmm. And why do they hate us? Because the evil that is in them sees the good that is in us and naturally hates it. Well, at that time, my point of reference for Cromwell's speech was Reagan's Evil Empire speech, because in fact the two speeches are very similar. Mm-hmm. Obviously, after September 11th, there was a whole new and very fertile field of comparisons and reflections to be had.
Mm-hmm. And you, where you quote the Cromwell speech, you quote a Muslim figure as essentially positing the same thing about us, that we were evil.
Yeah, well, that's, again, you've got, the book looks at Cromwell's speech and then runs it up to Reagan's Evil Empire speech, mm-hmm. and to Bush's speeches about Osama bin Laden. And it, what it finds is that the English speakers, from Cromwell to Bush, have had a certain case to make. Mm-hmm. They've seen the world in a certain way. And they've seen the Anglophone side as standing for liberty, progress, you know, for the rights of small nations against oppressors and so on and so forth. But then on the other side, again, you find a discourse that over 300 years has also had its continuities. They say, you talk about your liberty, but what you call mm-hmm. liberty is really the freedom to oppress and crush mm-hmm. other people. Mm-hmm. And you talk about human rights, this is all hypocrisy. Look at what you British are doing in Ireland. Look at what you Americans are doing to the Indians. Look at Abu Ghraib. There is a kind of a, again, there are these two sides that have been slinging mud at each other. And what's interesting to me is that on each side, it's the same mud, you know.
That's right. And in fact, I found that quote. It's, "We worship God by loathing America," said Tariq Hilmi.
Exactly.
Yeah. So in a way, you're actually, how do I want to say this? You're actually saying, well, look, this is what in history people have been saying about us. And then you actually chronicle that. It's a very elaborate history. So this is not new, what we're hearing today about America, and that when people criticize us in the past and now, they're also responding to different aspects of the system that you're describing as the Anglo-American maritime system.
That's right. What feels to us like the extension of order and liberty and prosperity, triumph of liberal democratic capitalism, to other people looks like the destruction of all human values and also the development of an international power which wants to crush everybody who stands in its path.
And in a way, is it fair to say that this system, which we'll talk about in 1 second, really created enormous power that could shape the world? And so there is a reality there which you're willing to accept.
Yeah, actually, you're right. They're not wrong. First, yeah. Actually, the Dutch invented this in the 17th century. But the Dutch, the British, and the Americans have all, using this maritime order, constructed international systems that have brought them to the absolute pinnacle of world power. So when other people look at this and say, this system is making you extremely powerful and extremely rich, mm-hmm. They're correct.
And so the Anglo-American system, which I want you to talk about now, first in its cultural component, really brings together a number of historical trends and opportunities that were in the first instance presented to the Dutch, then the British, and then the Americans. Yeah. Talk a little about what you call the Whig narrative and how all of these things came to embody a system of values.
Well, if you look at what happened, beginning with the Dutch, who, as I say, kind of invented this system, you get the idea that the foundation of world power turns out to be to have an open society at home. That is to say, in the 17th century, the Dutch are saying you can be Protestant, you can be Catholic, as long as you're not too loud about it, you can have no religion, you can even be Jewish. Come here, live peacefully, obey the civil laws, make money, and make money however you want. If you're a peasant, you can be a trader. So you see this tremendous upsurge in innovation, philosophical, technological, financial. They had the world's first stock market. They had the world's first speculative bubble, the famous tulip bubble in Amsterdam. And this open society, which for the Dutch was kind of fulfilling their own vision of a certain religious worldview, had the impact then of making them tremendously rich and powerful, because as they went out into the rest of the world with the products of this society, with the commercial acumen, the financial leverage, the products made by these technologies, they were able to defeat the Spaniards, defeat the Portuguese, and establish a country the size of Maryland was able to build this global power. So this I think is the origin of the system.
And then it essentially this mantle of the Whig narrative and all that it embodied passed to Britain. Basically.
That's right. During the wars against France in the late 17th, early 18th century, the British defended the Dutch from the French with one hand and then picked their pockets with the other, which is pretty much what we did to the British in World War II. And so the system survived. Its center of gravity changed. We moved from Amsterdam to London, yes.
And I think you're suggesting that the set of values was really very complex.
Yep.
But in the end, it emphasized the individual. It emphasized the skepticism and the search for truth, while at the same time maintaining important components of religion.
Right. There is a kind of a belief that a lot of people seem to have that there's a sort of a tragic trade-off between modernity and tradition, and therefore modernity and religion. So that you have on the one hand the world of the sacred, which is unchanging, hallowed by time, and then you have this sort of modern world where you have to make compromises and do things in different ways. Many societies around the world are torn by the conflict between what they see as their religious aspiration and then the necessities of living in the capitalist system. For the Anglo-Americans, it just hasn't worked out that way to the same extent. There's a sense, and I look at it, and you know, I think you see it today in the very individualistic, evangelistic kind of religion that we have. People look to sort of God's call to Abraham. You know, you're saved by faith, which is such a key part of Protestantism, to be saved by faith rather than by works and by tradition. And God's call to Abraham is leave your father's house, your mm-hmm. father's gods, and go to a new land where I'm going to show you the promise. Mm-hmm. So that somehow in Anglo-American culture, and I think this is true for people who are not religious as well as for many people who are, the idea that there's change in your life is not a challenge to your roots don't depend on the absence of change. In some ways, you're rooted in change itself. Mm-hmm. So that in a capitalist society where generation by generation, the economy is changing, technology is changing, society is changing, this is not challenging who you are. At some very deep level, it's affirming who you are. And I think that is part of what has given Anglo-American society the confidence and the affinity for capitalism that in some ways has kept them on the cutting edge of world history for so long.
And you use concepts developed by Bergson and Popper to talk about the difference between closed and open societies. And you're suggesting, I think you call it the Goldilocks moment, where all of these things came together, that Protestantism, as it developed in the countries that we're talking about, the Dutch, the English, and then maybe here, that there was the way things sort of hung together was toward an open society. And why did that matter? And explain to us what an open society okay. means in this context.
Well, most people today know of the concept of the open society essentially through Karl Popper, as channeled in a sense by George Soros. But Popper's source for open and closed society was Henri Bergson. Open society is a closed society is a society bound by tradition. Mm-hmm. So a hive of bees would be a perfect example of a completely closed society. Everything runs on instinct. Every bee knows what it's supposed mm-hmm. to do, and every bee does what it's supposed mm-hmm. to do, a closed society. And traditional human societies, you know, the idea that there's a tremendous, you know, let's do this the way the ancestors did it. Let's do the right thing in the right way. We, you know, people from the fish clan don't marry people from the bear clan. That's the way it is. Mm-hmm. And then in an open society, you say that custom is replaced by conscience. And as an individual, you're aware that you have the right and maybe even the duty to live in a different way from what your parents did. You mm-hmm. you don't do the same work your father did or your mother did. You don't maybe have the same kind of family situation. You don't need necessarily live in the same part of the country. You might have a different type of friends. You might listen to different music, not the traditional music of your people, but something else that you happen to hear and like. So an open society is a constantly changing one. Now, Popper, Bergson, who developed this concept, believed that both kinds of society are rooted in human nature. On the one hand, human beings have certain instincts, and you know, if you imagine, he was an evolutionary philosopher, so he thought about the development of human society over millennia, and people needed certain kinds of coherence to be able to survive. People might die at 30 and 40, and so there's a certain wisdom in how to farm or what to do and so on. And so these traditions are encoded wisdom. So there's a legitimate need in human beings for a closed society. But Bergson also saw, if you look back over millennia, that human beings kind of have radiated all over the earth, so that people whose ancestors were hunting baboons on the Serengeti are now living in igloos hunting seals by the Arctic. And so obviously there has to be a capacity for change. And in Bergson's view, static religion is what he calls the sort of forces inside us that try to keep us behaving the way we've always mm-hmm. behaved. So if you start to violate some taboo, you feel sick or you start to shiver, you hear voices in your head saying, don't do that, you have nightmares, whatever it may be. These voices from outside your ordinary experience are causing you to conform your behavior to the tradition. But Bergson also thought there was what he called dynamic religion, which is God's call to Abraham, leave your father. It's no good for you here anymore. You have to go over the hills and go. You're going to have to eat different animals and live in a different way. And so that's not rational or rationalistic. It's also based on something deep inside, and it appears to individuals as a transcendental call of some kind. Mm-hmm. And Bergson, when Popper adopted this to politics, kind of left dynamic religion out of the picture, so that the open society for Popper is just the creature of reason, mm-hmm. and as I think it was Sartre who said, religion is always on the gods are always on the side of the right. Mm-hmm. That is to say, static religion, so that one has to spurn mm-hmm. tradition and spurn, in a sense, the religion and spurn spirituality to be progressive. Anglo-American society, really since the English Reformation, has been working its way toward a vision of a much more dynamic sense of religion, where this notion of being called to change is the dominant force.
Mm-hmm. You're dealing here with a myth, and the myth is that religion and capitalism and dynamic change went separate ways. But you hearken back to Adam Smith to actually point out that Smith recognized that there was a place for religion for the peasants who had come to the cities and were caught up in this dynamism. So in a way, I'll see if I can find the quote, but that the lamb of religion had to lie down and was lying down even in that time with the lion of capitalism.
Right. Yes, Smith actually saw that urbanization, which in the early stages of capitalist development, and we're seeing it certainly around the Third World, and I think it accounts for some of the upsurge in Islam and the urbanization mm-hmm. of traditional people as young people leave the countryside. and go to the city, they're faced with a new social situation. They've lost the they don't live in the village where everyone knows you and where your role is very settled. You're in this new world. And there are many dangers and temptations. A young kid from the city can go wrong very quickly and get hooked on drugs or get involved in crime. Life can, if you're poor, life can just be destroyed in a week, as Smith says. And so these recent urban immigrants find a refuge in often a fundamentalist, Smith called it a fanatical kind of religion. And that helps them order their behavior, and it recreates that traditional community in the city. You might think this was, you might look at that and say this is a flight from modernity. Mm-hmm. But Smith's insight, and it's one that I think remains valid, was that actually this was a process of enabling individuals to cope with modernity. Mm-hmm. And Smith was concerned that theoretically this kind of fanatical religion could pose a threat to civil liberties and so on. But he thought that at least in the English case, and I think also in the American case, the diversity of these religious groups would mean that no one of them could hope to dominate society. And so that even if the march of capitalism, in a sense, spawns rigid or fanatical religious groups, the sheer plurality of these groups will ensure that society continues to become more open, even though you have lots of people in the society who don't necessarily share the philosophical beliefs of an open society. And I think that's true.
And so in the end, what you're suggesting is that Protestantism in this world that we're talking about linked up with capitalism because there was a unique combination of tradition, revelation, and reason, that the skepticism was possible, and hence this was an invitation to change and in a way finding religious sanction and change.
Right. Well, Milton, people thought when the Reformation first hit England that what would happen would be you'd have a big to-do and a tumult, but then you'd find the truth, and then the arguing over religion would stop, because after all there must be one true religion and everyone has to know what it is. But as time went on, it was clear that, the dissent wasn't stopping. It was proliferating. And you had people running around, the Puritans and others who believed, like Wahhabi Muslims do today about the Quran, everything you need to know is in this book. Mm-hmm. And this book not only will tell you how to organize your religious life and your relationship with God, it will tell you how to organize your church. It will tell you what powers the king should have. It will tell you, how you should choose your civil magistrates. It will tell you rules of science. Everything you need to know is in this book. And so obviously the task is to organize civil society according simply to the book. But you also had, but then you instantly found people were quarreling bitterly mm-hmm. over what that book meant, and you had different interpretations. Then you had people who thought, well, wait a minute, we're all going to disagree on that book. We'll never get a solution there. How do we determine truth? Well, our tradition, we have a tradition of the king. We have our tradition of common law. We have our sense of Englishness, and we have to interpret the scripture by the light of our tradition. Mm-hmm. And you have other people who say, well, reason is really the key. And so at the time, in the early 18th century England, what you had was a society where you're divided. You have this triangle, and you have people saying, no, it's the book, it's the book. And people saying, tradition, tradition. And other people saying, let's just reason, reason. Mm-hmm. Sort of Jerry Falwell, Al Gore, and I don't know, Andrew Jackson maybe, or would be the three counterparts in American life. Nobody could win. Mm-hmm. And people had to begin to live with this uncertainty where society went in a place that nobody wanted it to go necessarily because there was no consensus on how to shape it.
Now, before we talk about how this Anglo-American culture was hooked with Anglo-American power, which I think is very important in your narrative, I want to bring it up to the present because you're suggesting that in our time there are two major narratives. One is the Abrahamic, Abrahamic, which you have touched on briefly, but in a nutshell, is the narrative of Jews, Christians, and the Muslim world versus the capitalist narrative. What's the difference between those two narratives, and how are they similar?
Well, it is interesting because we live in a time when a lot of people, and especially maybe academics, have come to believe that there are no more grand narratives, no big stories that shape the world. But I look around the world, and it seems to me that we're more under the influence of grand narratives than ever. And there are two leading ones. There is this, what I call in the book, Abrahamic history. And if you think about Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, one of the things they have, and one of the many things they have in common, is that history begins with man in more or less the right relationship to God. Then something happens and something goes wrong. And the story, and you know, in Christian, it's original sin, the fall of man, and there are different versions in the other religions. And then God enters history. And history is the process of God bringing man back to the right relationship with God. And this middle period, the historical period, will end when the Messiah comes back, or when Jesus returns, or in Islam, actually, when Jesus returns and there's the final judgment. And so if you think about Marxism, you think about other forms of secular ideology that have been developed in the West, they're rather similar. There's the in Marx, you have primitive equality, primitive communism, then classes come into history, and you have a historical process where ultimately we're going to resolve these contradictions and everything will be resolved again. And so that's what I call kind of the Abrahamic narrative of history as the story of a problem and a process, and the end of history is the solution of the problem. Then you have on the, you know, and that is ideologically, that's what almost everyone in the world, even people who come from Buddhist or other backgrounds, whether it's a secular form or religious form of this, that's the way people construe human experience. Then on the other hand, you have this story of capitalism, the rise of capitalism, and it's, you know, begins in a few places in Europe and now has spread to become this global system and has taken us God knows where. Well, how does the rise of capitalism fit into this Abrahamic narrative of, you know, an investigation of the meaning of history? And it says, what is the meaning of capitalism? Is this part of mankind's return to God or to a perfect state? Or is capitalism some horrible deviation? Is it a sign of the problem that we're in? So, yeah, the book looks at those two narratives.
Mm-hmm. And you're really saying not necessarily. Isn't that the answer to the question you just posed? Because if are you saying that in a way, if you recognize this religious connection, that becomes an important element in seeing purpose in the capitalist narrative?
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is that the Anglo-Americans, by and large, have come to link the two together.
Yeah. Okay.
And say that the unfolding of capitalism is part of God's work to redeem humanity. Mm-hmm. And so that we, you know, and the fact that the Anglo-Americans have been at the leading edge of capitalism and under capitalism they have come to play such a dominant role in world history, the Anglo-Americans have somewhat naturally said, well, that just shows that this is all good. It's all, they see capitalism as creating a world in their image, where liberal democratic capitalism, which is the sort of way of being that feels natural to us, is now spreading around the world. Other people are adopting it, sometimes not very happily, it's true. And meanwhile, the fact that we're able to pursue this program so well brings us wealth and power. All of this looks to us like a very good case of God's will being done on mm-hmm. earth. And it helps, again, people who are not religious still see this in terms of natural law or the force at work. And so they see the spirit of freedom triumphing in the world. And so there's, you know, there is this tendency towards a tremendously triumphalist view of history, which is, I think, where you get things like the end of history, or Woodrow Wilson saying World War I is the war to end war and we're going to win. That's a startlingly ambitious thing to say. Mm-hmm. But because we see capitalism, this global transformation, as the latest stage in the Abrahamic transformation of the human condition, it just all fuses together for us.
Mm-hmm. Now let's go back to power, because if we go back in history, you're also, in throughout the book, demonstrating how institutions emerged within capitalism and within the political economy of capitalism that secured this trajectory, on the one hand domestically, but on the other hand made these maritime powers that we're talking about powerful, more powerful than the other parts of the world, whether the underdeveloped world or the rivals in Europe. Talk a little about that, because that dynamic becomes important in two respects. How hard it was to build this, basically, mm-hmm. with institutions, but then it gives a sense of the impact of this global power on parts of the world that aren't there yet.
Well, one of the things I look at in the book is sport as an example of this. Almost every sport in the world today that's played by a lot of people is played under rules that were developed essentially between about 1850 and 1900 in either Britain or the United States. Soccer, American football, cricket, baseball, modern track and field, swimming, hockey, lacrosse. Many of these games originated outside these countries. Now, what is at work here? But even the whole idea, by the way, of teams organized into leagues and mm-hmm. all of this stuff comes out of that one era and those two places. There are two passions in the human mind that are often separate. One is the passion to compete. You know, I want to win. I want to be better than the other guy. The other is to regulate, you know, and to organize. Anglo-American sport represents a kind of a marriage of those two things, where, you know, the English Croquet Association looked at this ancient game of royal tennis, and said, you know, this game doesn't have what it takes. Let's write some rules that will make a sport that is more competitive and more interesting. And they came up with what we now know as tennis. And, you know, they said, let's have some rules that make it possible to have more interesting, more exciting competition. They're not regulations to protect the losers from the winners mm-hmm. or to end competition. But if you want to have truly far-sweeping, truly keen, truly international competition, you have to have a clear and unambiguous set of rules. To a certain degree, this is what they turn to that's the way they've done with the economy. That they don't regulate the economy to suppress capitalism and to keep this dangerous fire from engulfing us all. Rather, it's, you know, sort of like you have a trellis that your rose bush is going to climb, and you want the thing to go high and bloom more. So your regulations are seen as enabling and supporting the competition rather than trying to cut it off or limit its consequences. And this is ultimately a cultural preference. You know, it comes out of Anglo-American experience and culture, and this vision is one that works for us. Now, a capitalist system that develops in this way, and finance has been really mm-hmm. since the 17th century the main tool, suddenly the Anglo-Americans have developed this global financial system that is so powerful that not because it has more money than other things, you know, it does, but because it enables people to use resources more efficiently. Mm-hmm. We've developed incredibly complex forms of finance. Sometimes they melt down, as in the subprime crisis. But we always try to figure out, you know, okay, well, that means our regulatory structure had a hole in it. Let's repair the hole so that we can have an even bigger, even more dynamic and far-reaching system. This financial system then inevitably transforms the conditions for other people in other parts of the world, because suddenly they're facing corporations that have all the power and agility that this financial system gives them, or they're facing technologies that proceed out of this Anglo-American nexus. And that, so this cultural preference creates international power, and it forces other people around the world. In a sense, they've got to learn to play our game mm-hmm. by our rules, or they risk being overwhelmed.
And in fact, this can help us understand why this Anglo-American system won all these wars throughout history, because they were able to float the bonds to pay for the war and so on.
Exactly. The English in the 18th century, they had a smaller GDP than the French. They had a smaller population than the French, but they kept winning the wars. And one of the big reasons was the French treasury kept going bankrupt, and the English kept figuring out new clever ways to finance bigger government borrowing. Mm-hmm.
So this Anglo-American capitalist juggernaut moves across the world, but it has responses that we're seeing today, but which you say go back in history. And I think you make reference to ghost dancers, which essentially are sometimes generated by religious movements that call on the spirits to oppose what is perceived as the devastation of this system.
Right. Well, let's look, you know, in the 19th century, you can see China and Japan, two countries with ancient cultures, tremendous sense of identity, and they're both suddenly confronted with British and American power and trade and all of this stuff, and they've got to figure out what to do. The Japanese manage fairly quickly to learn to play enough of the game so that they start to become a major player themselves. China in the 19th century was completely incapable of dealing with what happened. And it suffered humiliation and war and it was just a devastating thing. And toward the end of the 19th century, when things just seem to be going absolutely downhill and has reached the bottom in China, you get what we know as the Boxer Rebellion. And this was a movement of Chinese who are saying, basically, you know, what's wrong with China today isn't that the English culture is better than ours, or that English God is better than our gods, or in every way we are better than these horrible people. Mm-hmm. But our problem is we haven't been true to who we are. We have let ourselves be corrupted by compromise. Mm-hmm. And so the Boxers believed that, you know, if they used ancient Chinese techniques and were in conformity with Chinese culture, they would be invulnerable to the weapons of the British. And they were supported, you know, by very senior figures. The Dowager Empress of China was supporting them in the hope that maybe they could drive mm-hmm. the foreigners out. But this is not isolated. In 1856, I think it was, a young woman named Nonkwawusa of the Xhosa people in South Africa was down by the river. And she heard the gods saying, the British at the time, you know, they'd established a fort, they had taken territory. They said, Nonkwawusa, the Xhosa are in trouble, not because the gods aren't powerful or the ways aren't right, but you haven't been faithful. Show your faith. Mm-hmm. Kill all the cattle, and then we will redeem you. And they killed all the cattle. Mm-hmm. So the Sioux Indians with the ghost dancing, it was the same. The Carlists in Spain believed that the priests blessed their scapulars. They couldn't be beaten by the liberal government. They couldn't be wounded by the bullets of the infidels. This kind of ghost dancing response,
which sounds familiar today when we look at the
well, movie. I think in some ways you can look at a movement like Al-Qaeda and related movements and see a certain kind of ghost. You know, it's a, you know, damn it, you know, we're not at the, it is, first of all, the culture feels the assault is overwhelming. We look on our TV, they're there. We look at the state of Israel, they're there. We look at our ruler, we look at our economy is becoming like theirs. You know, we're just, everywhere you look, this influence is there. What is wrong? You know, well, it can't be that we have something to learn from these people. And so you do have this, if we could just find the true path. Now, fortunately, this ghost dancing phenomenon is not the only thing that takes place. I mean, it tends to be a minority response. What the important thing about ghost dancing is, it says, here is a culture that is truly mm-hmm. reached, in a sense, kind of a breaking point. And what happens over and over again, the really important thing that happens here is that culture then finds within itself, not in a ghost-dancing, reactionary way, but in a much more dynamic way, the resources, in a sense, to reinvent itself as a successful participant in this system. And I point out to people, you know, for example, that at the time of the Boxer Rebellion, you have Sun Yat-sen beginning to think about the first Chinese Republic and how that works. Mm-hmm. Or you look in the history of the Xhosa people, Nangkwa Wusa is not the great name in their history. It's Nelson Mandela. So it's at this moment of great crisis that you start to see real change and real adaptation. And I think ultimately the hope that we have in the Middle East is that we're going to see this kind of positive adaptation.
Mm-hmm. And when you've taken us on a journey which lets us really see who we are and why they think the way they do about us, that is our adversaries. And this leads you to two conclusions that I want to talk about. One I see is what you call the diplomacy of civilizations. Tell us what you have in mind here. I think you're saying that culture is very important, and we have to recognize that in the power equation.
You know, the Fukuyama's end of history argument is sort of the latest iteration, as he'd be the first to say, of Hegel's idea of that all human history is headed in the same direction. Mm-hmm. People are the same everywhere. They want the same things. And so ultimately, the world that we end up is, you know, what's true in France is true in Berlin, and we're all going to end up together somehow. Mm-hmm. And it's cosmopolitan. Huntington's clash of civilization concept goes back to people like Herder and more recently people like Isaiah Berlin, who say, wait a minute. Different civilizations, different cultures mean that people don't actually want the same thing. And we're not, you know, history is not all of us going up the same mountain to the same place. History is more like a lot of different trees in a forest all growing up. Mm-hmm. And they don't merge at the top into one uber tree. They remain, each tree remains itself going up. And so there's a clash between the concept of universal Hegelian or Fukuyama history and particular or Huntingtonian kind of history. What I'm really saying is that we've got both of these phenomena on our hands. It's not either Huntington or Fukuyama, it's both. That is, this capitalist system, liberal capitalism, is a system that because it is so efficient and so dynamic, really does everybody in the world faces what the Japanese and the Chinese did in the 19th century. You have to figure out a way to live with this. There's no way out of it. And in that sense, it's universal history. Mm-hmm. And we are the kind of cutting edge of that. And so we present ourselves to people around the world as the American way. And you got to, you know, you don't have to love it. You can hate it all you want. But if you don't cope with it, you'll be overwhelmed one way or another.
And, please, go ahead.
And then but on the other hand, the fact is that people do then respond to this universal force, not as Americans or Anglo-Americans, but in their own way. And they reach their own individual cultural accommodations with that. And what we have to face is that this task is easier for some cultures and civilizations than others. So, for example, the French really have never liked Anglo-American liberalism. They hate it as much now as they did in the 17th century, and it's caused them a lot of heartache and heartburn over the years. But they've always been able, when the chips are down, to manage the challenge one way or another. You know, they remain French, they remain prosperous, and we haven't been able to just walk all over them and ignore them. But it's more difficult. It's more difficult for smaller cultures or cultures whose assumptions and historical experiences are more radically different than the French. We see over time some cultures like the Chinese couldn't handle this in the 19th century. They are far more successful today. Ditto in the 19th century, the Indians were more or less overwhelmed by the British presence. These days, they've not only managed to chase the British out, but they are playing this game globally and very successfully. So cultures can change. The cultures that can't deal with it can learn to deal with it. But the process of dealing with this universal force is the background for people all over the world. Now, we as Americans think our culture is so universal, we must be beloved, everyone must imitate us, and furthermore, we obviously know more than anybody else about how to build these cultures, because look at the, we have one. In fact, and so we behave, we can often behave very arrogantly, we can often behave in ways that alienate people, we can also be completely unaware of the dynamics that other people are dealing with. So when I talk about a diplomacy of civilizations, I'm saying recognize that intercultural, intercivilizational relations and conflict is here to stay, and needs to be, but needs to be managed, and to a certain degree can be managed. We can try to conduct ourselves in a more effective way, but we can also simply by recognizing the validity of some of these other perspectives reduce some of the tension and the conflict.
At this point in your narrative, you turn to Reinhold Niebuhr. And I think you're suggesting that he had a concept both of almost self-containment, really, that you recognize that human sin is in a way based on self-regard. This is true of individuals, but they learn to recognize the rights and interests and emotions of others. But this also applies to groups and nations.
Yeah. One of the many things that I like about Reinhold Niebuhr's thought is that he takes some of the core concepts of Anglo-American religion and identity and produces out of these a way of thinking about the limits on American assertion and also ways that Americans can reconceive their relationships with other cultures. Because he says, the great thing that we do that is so dangerous, and we all do it as individuals, as you say, is we think of ourselves as the moral center of the universe. And it's a natural thing. We all do it in individual lives. We slowly become a little bit less narcissistic, and we learn to play a little bit better with others and so on. Anybody who's watching young children arguing in a sandbox can see this process at work. Collectivities are more difficult. Like when I'm too egotistical about myself, I'll often see how ridiculous it'll be. But when I'm patriotic for my nation, it's harder for me to see that and harder for me to understand other people's sense of nationality. For my religion, it's even tougher because, you know, it's the religion of it's the one true religion of the one true God, and it should be spread everywhere. And it's again, I don't. When I try to crush your religion, I don't think, oh, I'm doing something wrong, or I'm crushing. I'm doing you a favor. I'm bringing you to the one true religion. So how do we learn to live effectively in a world that is so dominated by these collective identities, where this narcissistic moral self-centeredness reigns rampant? And I think, but at the same time, we can't just say, "Oh, I'm completely wrong. I'm sorry." In reality, some people would like to say, "Well, America should stop being capitalistic and should stop doing all of the things that we're." We can't. This is our culture. Is, you know, to dare, to do, to change, to try, to live and let live, be free. We can't stop being that kind of person. And that inevitably has an impact on other people. So what Niebuhr says is you don't give up your identity, but you learn to critique yourself even while affirming yourself. You get a sort of a more mature view of your civilization and your culture. And I think that's probably a good thing for us to do as a society.
So in a way, one could say that asked to give a report card to recent American foreign policy, you wrote this book, basically, because in the end, what the reader is left with is what we are is a very complex story and of institutional and cultural development over hundreds of years. And so we have to move away from a notion that we can come in on day one and in a few days change the place?
Well, I would, you know, that ultimately other people have a lot to do with what goes on in the world. And yet at the same time, you see, I can't buy the idea that we should, you know, that we're going to stop changing the world. You know, that sort of, there's some people who say, well, America should kind of leave the Middle East. And if we'd left them alone, you know, we wouldn't have some of these problems. Might be true to some degree, but I'm not sure that we can. The world needs the oil that's in the Middle East, needs a secure geopolitical system that can get the oil to the customers and get the money to the people who are selling the oil. It needs, and meanwhile, we're sitting here developing our own communications technologies, whether it's the internet, satellite TV, producing cultural products and ideas for us, but that then spread so that the confrontation between us and the Middle East, parts of the Middle East, is not something that we can turn on or off by tweaking our foreign policy. We can do things that make it worse, and perhaps we could substitute those for some things that make it better, but the real grounds of conflict and division don't result from our foreign policy mistakes as much as they do from the essence of the way who we are is impacting the way they see themselves.
I get this in both this book and Special Providence. You strongly believe that we have to know our own history, whether you're talking about U.S. foreign policy or the in this case the Anglo-American, to really understand who we are, and then that really will help us understand what we should do in the world. Not it won't tell us whether we invade Iraq or not, but right. it'll give us a big picture sense of how we relate to the world today.
I really do believe that, I think it's kind of a shame that a lot of the history that the next generation in particular is going to need to make wise choices isn't being emphasized as much. You know, even the very sort of idea of an Anglo-American identity or Anglo-American history is not really taught as much as it used to be. And you have quite well-educated Americans who don't realize, say, that the Declaration of Independence was in many ways modeled on the British Declaration of Right, understand the deep connections between the English religion of the 17th century and American culture today. And if you don't know who you are, it's going to be very hard to deal with other people, I think.
Do you foresee a future in which the Chinese way of doing capitalism or the Indian way of doing capitalism might in the end challenge and overthrow the system that you're describing?
Well, I think anything is possible. One of the things, you know, here I've got kind of an analysis which says history is an open-ended process and can't be predicted with certainty. So yeah. I can't tell you that could be ruled out. But I do think that that for the foreseeable future, the Americans are destined to play a substantial role in world politics, partly because of the economy, but partly because of sort of geopolitics. And the fact, for example, in Asia is that we're not just looking at the rise of one nuclear superpower with a billion people, we're looking at two. Mm-hmm. And that means that the rise of China is not the same thing as the rise of Asia. And so the U.S. is kind of an offshore balancing power, is likely to play a surprisingly large role in world events. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to be stuck for the foreseeable future with a role that looks very much like the Dutch or the British role or our own role in the last half century.
Now, and one final question, which is that in the recent period, it seems that whether right or wrong, has overemphasized the military dimension of our power, and even so far as to think that enormous military power could bring the Anglo-American cultural system, put it in place with institutions. And you're really suggesting, after one goes through this history, although you don't directly address the question, that we have to back away from that because it's the richness of the whole system in terms of values that will ensure our place in the future.
You know, it's tough. As you say, this is not a system that gives you a lot of, you know, it's not a quick handbook for what you should do tomorrow. But, you know, certainly this system would say that invading Pakistan and occupying Pakistan would not turn Pakistan into the south of England. And therefore, probably, unless you have compelling other reasons, you should stay out. On the other hand, it does... history does suggest that a military has played a role, for example, in bringing when Germany and Japan saw that the road of violent resistance was completely closed. In a sense, you know, Hitler was kind of a ghost dancer in his way, you know, saying that the Teutonic truth within us is greater than this Anglo-American worthless trashy truth out there. And if we are true to ourselves, you know, when that door is completely shut, then people begin to look at other ways of living. So I guess what I would say is that the last 300 years would suggest that military power is an important part of what has made the system work. But if you start to think it's the only part or, you know, is the thing that you should reach for first, probably there are a lot of other things you should try before you go down that road.
Walter, on that note, I want to thank you for being here. I'm going to show your book again, God and Gold. I think it will take its place beside Special Providence as a book that everybody is going to want to read and every class in this field is going to want to adopt. So thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for those kind words.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.